for you, Sarah, the charity and the story that Lisa has told is obviously very, very personal. Does that change anything in terms of the performance for you?
I think I knew this friend of Lisa's son as well, and the family, and I've got to know them in the last couple of years really well. So I've sort of lived it too in a from the sidelines slightly, but performing on that stage last Monday was really emotional, and I have to say there were a lot of tears in front of us, which was challenging at times, obviously from our point of view. But it's so lovely to perform music and make people have a strong feeling, and that might be sadness, but it might also be we often make people smile too, so, or dance even, you know.
Well, absolutely, we would be dancing in the studio, I'm sure, if we could. Sarah Malik and Lisa Rollin, the violin duo Red Hot Strings, with their Fairy Tale of New York single in aid of the charity Child Bereavement UK. That's it from me today on The Times at One. My producer was Lizzie Highfield, and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. Next on Times Radio, Jane Mulkerran's in for Jane and Fee.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock and you're listening to Jane Mulkerran's in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here today on Times Radio. Coming up on the show, bosses will have to tell staff about their right to join a union under new government plans. The Times politics team will be here to tell us more, and we'll hear from them about the ongoing rumbles about Keir Starmer's leadership. Ukraine's President Zelensky is meeting Keir Starmer today after difficult talks with Donald Trump's team. We'll speak to experts in Ukraine and in the US about the negotiations with Russia. And the Times' Patrick Kidd has traded on gossip throughout his professional life, including during his time as our diary editor. We'll talk to him about the topics sure to come up at this year's Christmas parties, and we'll ask him what the worst thing you can possibly say over the Volavants is. Plus, we'll talk Christmas scams in Money Matters with Adam Shaw, and we'll throw open the doors of our literary salon. But first, the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine cannot do without either Europe or America as he meets Sir Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz in Downing Street.
Things which are very important for today, I think unity between Europe and Ukraine, and also unity between Europe, Ukraine and the United States. There are some things which we can't manage without Americans, things which we can't manage without Europe, and that's why we need to make some important decisions.
Emmanuel Macron said the Russian economy is starting to suffer, especially after the latest sanctions. Friedrich Merz said he is sceptical about some of the details in documents coming from the US. Former Premier League footballer Joey Barton has avoided jail after being found guilty of writing grossly offensive social media posts. He was convicted last month of targeting football pundits Lucy Ward and Ennio Luco and the broadcaster Jeremy Vine. The 43-year-old has been given a six-month suspended sentence. Judge Andrew Mennery said Barton crossed the line between free speech and a crime.
A sustained campaign of online abuse that was not mere commentary, but targeted, extreme and deliberately harmful. And these convictions represent a clear rejection of your assertion that your conduct was merely robust debate.
Kemi Badenoch is calling on the government to speed up a national inquiry into grooming gangs. The Tory leader told a news conference she wants the role played by race, religion and culture to be more closely examined. The investigation is currently without a chair. Fiona Goddard, who was abused herself, explained why she quit the process.
Making decisions without listening to survivors' opinions and it feeling more like a box-ticking exercise. There was concerns over the scope being expanded. The inquiry needs to stay laser-focused. And it needs to bring accountability and justice.
The EU could be about to ban words like sausage and burger to describe plant-based foods. The European Commission is mulling the change and could decide as soon as Wednesday. Under the proposed rules, calling them vegan or vegetarian wouldn't be enough to get around the restrictions. More details from EU correspondent Jack Parrock.
Oat milk in the EU is called an oat drink, but this is specific about burgers and sausages. It was seen as a win for the livestock community in the European Union when the Parliament voted in favour of it. But in order for it to become a full ban, it needs approval from the European Commission, a proposal, and then a set of rules and standards and regulations around it.
And Keir Starmer's launched a TikTok account. Downing Street says security mitigations are in place after the app was banned from government-issued devices over concerns about its Chinese parent company. The Prime Minister's first post shows him turning on the Christmas lights outside Number 10. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, good afternoon and welcome to the show. Today with me, Jane Mulkerins, keeping the studio warm for Jane and Fee on this wet and windy Monday. In my day job downstairs, I'm the associate editor at the Times magazine, and you might have heard me giving sneak previews of the magazine content every Thursday afternoon with Jane and Fee, or indeed popping into off-air sometimes too. But today, I'm with you for the next 2 hours, so thank you for your company this afternoon. It's great to be with you, and it's great to have you with us. Coming up between now and 3 o'clock, a year on from the fall of the Assad regime, Syria is reportedly on a knife edge, with chaos and violence stymieing the efforts to rebuild the country. We'll speak to a Syrian expert about the country's prospects for the future. And how would you feel about being offered a smaller stake simply because you're a woman? According to the chairman of the Obesity Healthcare Goals Programme, that's the government's obesity initiative, since we require fewer calories than the fellas, we should be given daintier dishes. I'm quite sure that many of you will have some feelings about that. And as football fans start planning their transatlantic trips for next summer, we'll be talking World Cup prices. The tournament looks set to be the most expensive ever, with the cheapest match tickets topping £400 and hotel rooms already reaching over £1,000 a night in some cities. And after 3 o'clock, as President Zelensky meets with European leaders here in London, we'll cross to Ukraine to speak to Oleksandr Mereshko, MP and Chair of Ukraine's Foreign Affairs Committee, and get his view on the latest peace proposal. Plus, we'll find out why Donald Trump is firing up that MAGA minibus and holding his first rally in 5 months tomorrow. And it's Monday, which means our regular money chat with Adam Sage and our literary salon, today with the Times Deputy Literary Editor, Laura Hackett. To get in touch on anything we're talking about today, please do send us a WhatsApp on 0333 003 2353. You can text us on 87222, and you can, of course, tweet us on X using the hashtag Times Radio. Now, let's find out what you're reading this afternoon on the Times website. The third most read story this Monday afternoon is that Trump is disappointed with Zelensky for not reading the peace plan. As President Zelensky meets Sir Keir Starmer in London, the Ukrainian leader says recent talks with the US have not been easy. We'll have the latest on those discussions soon and speak to the chair of Ukraine's Foreign Affairs Committee. The second most read story this afternoon is that we're almost broke and still paying for private school. A couple who work for the NHS and the RAF, respectively, have told the Times how they're doing everything they can to still give their children an independent education. And the most read piece on the Times website today is Dame Judi Dench, National Treasure, who says, "I remember reams of Shakespeare, but I am losing the plot." In a new documentary, the 90-year-old actress perfectly delivers a full Shakespearean soliloquy from a play she last performed 4 decades ago. You can, of course, read all of those articles at thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one, or maybe ask for one for Christmas. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And something that's also available exclusively to Times subscribers, and we need to mention it to you, that's our business newsletter, which delivers the latest financial and economic news from our incredible business editors straight to your inbox twice a day, Monday to Friday, with an additional special briefing every Sunday. You can sign up for the business newsletter. Just go to my account on the Times website or the live app. Subscribe to the Times today for many other fantastic benefits. Now, employers will be required to inform staff of their right to join a union under the new Employment Rights Bill, which is now in its final stages. Jackie Smith, the Minister for Skills, spoke to our own Kate McCann on Breakfast this morning.
Lots of good employers recognise the contribution that their partnership with trade unions can make for them in the workplace. People have a legal right to join a trade union, and what the government is suggesting here is that employers make that clear to their employees. And in terms of the statement, which is being consulted on at the moment, this is in order to help employers to have a sort of standard set of words that they can share with their employees to tell them about their rights to join a trade union.
The Prime Minister will likely be hoping that this announcement shifts the attention away from a more awkward development, in that Labour's biggest union backer, Unite, is considering whether to break from the party. The Times has also exclusively revealed today a key group, once run by Keir Starmer's chief of staff himself, is canvassing Labour members for alternatives to the Prime Minister. So it looks like it's shaping up to be another tricky week for the Prime Minister. Well, we're joined now by Oliver Wright, the Times policy editor. Good afternoon, Oliver.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being here this afternoon. Let's start with the workers' rights bill, Oliver. What would these changes mean for people joining companies?
So basically, it would put an obligation on companies to provide a statement to all employees about their rights to join a union, what that brings. And reason this is causing a bit of a row is because those rights would be written by, not by the employer, but by the government. Mm-hmm. The government is suggesting that it would create the form of words that employers would use to basically tell their employees about their rights. And a certain number of businesses say, look, you know, we've got really good industrial relations as it is. This whole thing is actually going to make life more difficult in the workplace and not better.
Mm. Andrew Griffiths, the shadow business secretary, has called them sinister and said they are government-dictated propaganda. I mean, is that a little bit harsh? I mean, do you think that the government has, you know, isn't necessarily intending this to be sinister?
Certainly the government isn't intending it to be sinister, but it does mark a change in the balance between employers and unions. The government is, you know, unapologetic about the fact that it wants to expand trade union membership across business. They think that, you know, some firms which actively discourage trade union membership have worse, you know, employment rights than others outside of the law, and they think that having more unions in the workplace will increase employee rights. But, you know, employers perhaps obviously have a slightly different view, that they see it as something that is time consuming, that takes them away from the sort of main focus in their business. And, you know, some say, actually, you know, we have very good employment rights as it stands, and if you bring in a union, you could potentially make things more adversarial.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because we're not a particularly unionised country anymore, are we? I think it's only 22% of British workers currently belong to a trade union. And it's been, you know, a very long and steep decline in membership since the 1970s. Will this initiative actually change that?
That is certainly what the trade union movement is hoping. I mean, you're absolutely right. There has been a long-term structural decline in union membership in the UK, partly as a consequence of, you know, what Thatcher did. That was rolled back slightly, but only slightly under the Blair New Labour government. And I think, you know, this is very much an ask of the unions of this Labour government, of Sir Keir Starmer. They wanted to tilt the balance, as I said before, back towards trade unions. And, you know, for a very obvious reason, that trade unions, their very existence relies on having increasing numbers of members, and their relevance relies on having lots of members. So if it's easier for, and workers would think beneficial for, them to be in the workplace, then, you know, it's good for them.
And is the Conservatives' argument that it will negatively impact British productivity and growth, does that hold any weight?
I think it's really hard to know. And I think, you know, it depends on the employer. If you've got a company where, you know, most workers are perfectly happy, there aren't any great complaints, then I suspect that many will think, well, I'm not really sure I can be bothered to have a union. I'm not sure I can be bothered to pay my subscription to a union. But you could find other cases where there are underlying complaints that people don't feel that they're well looked after. They don't think the company are taking their interests into account and haven't really thought about the prospect of a Union where, you know, you could see some change. But I think, you know, at this stage, it's really hard to make a judgment on what its impact will actually be.
Mm. Now, staying with the unions, Labour's biggest union backer, Unite, is considering whether to break from the party. What are their main concerns?
I mean, Unite have had concerns about Labour for a long time. It's probably the most left-wing of the unions. This was the union that was previously run by Len McCluskey, now being run by Sharon Graham. They've long had a difficult relationship with the Labour Party, really. Yeah, certainly under New Labour, but more recently since Sir Keir Starmer took over from Jeremy Corbyn. Now, it's an interesting question whether or not Unite actually would withdraw their financial funding, which is worth, you know, millions of pounds to Labour. You know, part of them would say, well, if we withdraw that money, then we lose our influence. But then others would say, well, what influence is it that we actually have at the moment? I think this is, at the moment, saber-rattling by Unite, but it could turn into something more substantive in the months ahead.
Mm. And what would be the bigger impact? Would it be the financial loss to the Labour Party, or would it be the optics, do you think?
I think, fundamentally, it would be the financial loss. Mm. I think it wouldn't be overly concerned by the optics of it. In some senses, it sort of, you know, shows that Labour isn't going to get pushed around by the unions. But I think, you know, it would be a financial blow to Labour. You know, it's not like they were in the run-up to the last election where people were sort of queuing up to give them money. You know, the polling suggests that it's going to be a very tight election. And I think that kind of, you know, loss of money from Unite would be a big thing. But equally, Unite would think, well, if we sort of took our cards off the table when you've got this close relationship election where you've got this chance of Nigel Farage entering Downing Street, is that really in the interests of Unite workers to basically turn their back on Labour?
Mm. Now, the Times' very own Labour whisperer, Patrick Maguire, has a story in the paper today about Labour Together, who've caused a little bit of upset. For anyone who's not an avid Westminster watcher, Ollie, explain who Labour Together are and why they are so significant in this particular administration.
So Labour Together was an organisation that was set up during the sort of, well, as they would see it, the dark years of Jeremy Corbyn. They were the group that was set up to sort of keep the flame of Blairism alive. And one of the people that set it up was a man called Morgan McSweeney, who is now Sir Keir Starmer's chief of staff in Downing Street. And ever since Starmer became prime minister, the group has had this sort of reputation almost for being the sort of talism of Starmerism. Yeah, they are the group that represents Starmer more than perhaps anybody else.
Right. And so how have they been causing a kerfuffle over the last kind of couple of days, it seems?
Yeah. So they have sent out a poll to Labour members, basically testing the ground for a whole bunch of different people in terms of who might succeed Sir Keir Starmer as Labour leader. Now, the group says there is nothing sinister in this. This is part of their sort of intelligence gathering. They're trying to work out what people think. There's nothing to see here. But still, it's kind of curious for a group that, you know, was previously run by Morgan McSweeney, that still has close links to Downing Street, to be actively questioning whether or not Starmer is the right person to lead Labour into the next general election. And that's why that story is really significant.
Yeah, I mean, presumably it's going to be quite hard for Keir Starmer and his team to try to face down any accusations of discontent when you've got such an insider group canvassing as to who's going to take the throne from him.
Yeah, and, you know, it is symbolic of what is going on amongst Labour MPs. You know, they are now actively questioning whether Starmer is going to lead them into the next general election, which is extraordinary if you consider the huge majority that Labour have and the fact that, you know, Starmer was the leader that won them that majority. But, you know, they all see the position in the polls. They all are looking, you know, at their own constituencies and whether they have a chance of surviving at the next election. And they're questioning, you know, well, if perhaps, you know, Wes Streeting, Angela Rayner, Andy Burnham, would any of those people as leader make it more likely that I kept my seat or not? And that really is what you're seeing with this Labour Together poll. It's an attempt by the group to work out, well, you know, is there someone who might be better at ensuring Labour gets a second term in power than the current Prime Minister?
Yeah, what do voters want? Keir Starmer's former political director, Luke Sullivan, spoke to Joe Coburn on Times Radio a little earlier. He gave his verdict on the leadership speculation.
The Prime Minister's fate is in his own hands. In my opinion, he has agency. Look, he has obviously had a really difficult first 15 months. I don't think anyone's saying that any of the candidates would have us in a better place. And actually, what I think this government needs to get on and focus is, yes, I know people, MPs, are obsessed about the leadership. They're obsessed about the polling position at the moment. But what we actually need, and I think what the country and voters want, is this Labour government to get on and govern and deliver and turn the situation round.
Do you think he can turn things round, Ollie?
I think it's really tricky because I think a lot of voters are just so sort of monumentally annoyed by this government that it's hard to see how, you know, at least in the short term, how they're suddenly going to turn around and say, oh, actually Labour aren't as bad as we think they are at the moment. But I think Luke is right that the election is still what, some 3 years away potentially, and a lot can happen. You know, if they can oversee a rise in living standards, if they can get NHS waiting times under control, if they can, you know, make people feel that the school system is working well, some of the sort of basic things that people are unhappy with at the moment, then maybe, you know, when in the privacy of the ballot box, people think, actually, you know what, he's probably the least of all worst options. And so I can see that, you know, there's the possibility to turn things around, but I think, you know, certainly at the moment, there's no immediate sign of it.
Mm. Before I let you go, Ollie, I'm curious, do you think that there's a chance that this could backfire amongst the electorate when this kind of polling is reported? I mean, the Tories were obviously heavily criticised for such a revolving door of leaders in those last few years of the previous administration. How could Labour guard against it being seen as having the same kind of problem of instability, really?
No, I agree with you. I mean, things like this poll probably, you know, it passes most voters by. But, and it's a big but, if Labour were to change their leader, voters would absolutely recognise that. They'd have a new Prime Minister. And I do think a lot of people would say, God, they are just like the Tories. They can't stick with their leader either. And I think that is a real risk for both, you know, Labour in terms of Keir Starmer, also the sort of speculation around whether Kemi Badenoch can survive as a Conservative leader, and Tory MPs suggesting that they might prefer someone else. Yeah, I don't think it does go down well with voters. Now, if there was a sort of coronation, if Labour MPs could decide, you know what, actually, you know, we don't think that Starmer's the right person, and together we're prepared to sort of put our differences aside and nominate one person as a better Prime Minister, then I think they might be able to get away with it. But if they end up with a sort of messy leadership campaign going over, yeah, a number of months, then I do think voters will think, you know, they are all the same. And that's something you hear voters say quite a lot. And I don't think it will do Labour any favours necessarily.
No, absolutely. Ollie, thank you so much for your insights this afternoon. It's great to speak to you. That's Oliver Wright, who is the Times policy editor. Well, coming up, what is the worst thing you can say at a Christmas party? It's 20 minutes past two here on Times Radio. This is Jane Mulcairns with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
How to win an election special on Times Radio.
Do you remember when everyone agreed with Nick?
I agree with Nick. I agree with Nick.
I'm Hugo Rifkind, and for a new special episode of How to Win an Election, we're joined by Nick Clegg to take us inside the 2010 election, a campaign which broke the mould of British politics.
Nick and I wanted to put aside party differences.
There's going to be a lot of change. This is what new politics looks like.
How to Win an Election, featuring Nick Clegg, this Thursday morning from 11 on Times Radio.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective, and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth, and the joy that meets you there. Silver Sea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms. The free bathroom design service includes a home visit. So when you're ready to plan your new bathroom, let the Wix experts measure up for you. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Good afternoon, it's 2:22 here on Times Radio with me, Jane Mulcairns, in for Jane and Fee today. Now, this week, next week, how many Christmas parties are you going to? I think I've got about 14, which might be more days than there are between now and Christmas. And alcohol-free beer, the mansion tax, advent calendar hyperinflation, Tesla owner ants and bad dog behaviour are reportedly the conversations we can all expect to have during our next Christmas party. The Times has compiled a list of the topics most likely to come up whilst you sip your champagne and nibble on a sausage roll. Or not, if you're on the Ozempic, which is one of the other topics very likely to come up at parties. Well, Times contributor and former diary editor Patrick Kidd, who can always be relied upon for deeply original Partly Chat, is here to tell us more. Good afternoon, Patrick.
Hello, Jane. How are you? Happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you too, Patrick. We're almost there. Patrick, is this a bit like those kind of words of the year from the dictionary people, a sort of snapshot of our current national obsessions?
I suppose so, yes. And inevitably, when we're trying to grapple for something new today with people we don't know, we look for something that's in the news. But actually, I try and look forward. I try and guess what we're going to be talking about in a few months' time. So when I'm chatting to people at parties, or sort of, what are your hopes for next year? What are you going to be doing over Christmas? I really don't want a conversation about Rachel Reeves. I think I've had enough Rachel Reeves conversations for my life. But also what I love about, actually, it's getting together with people you've maybe not seen all year. And it's the nostalgia chats. So, you know, I've got a school reunion coming up soon. And that's going to be exchanging stories that we've probably said at every reunion for the last 30 years. But it's going back to your happy place.
Mm.
And similarly, we had a lunch last Friday of former Times colleagues, most of whom no longer work for the paper. And again, you're sort of reliving old battles and old, you know, is so-and-so still alive and stuff like that. So I think Christmas is a time for comfort and nostalgia. But really, it's for avoiding the news altogether.
Yeah, okay, avoid the news. I think that small talk is a special skill, isn't it? I mean, I was reading a piece the other day in which a woman said she'd been to a party in Paris, which is probably, he tells you everything you need to know here, which a man had asked her, what's the most crucial question you are asking yourself right now? Which just, I mean, that's just, I mean, that's seven levels too deep for me at a party, especially if I've, you know, had more than one champagne. How do you approach small talk at parties so it's meaningful with strangers without sort of lapsing into the Rachel Reeves conversation?
Well, my terror is being introduced to someone that I should actually know, and not. There are times when I find my face blindness suddenly kicks in, and so actually, if you say to someone, you know, what are you up to? What are you doing at the moment? There's the story about someone once doing that and getting the response, well, still queen. But no, if you ask them what they're doing, because people like to talk about themselves. And then if it turns out they're really boring, then that's perhaps when you switch it on to the, well, here's what I'm looking forward to.
Mm. When you were diary editor, which I know involved going and making a lot of small talk, but also trying to get stories out of people, what was your technique to get people talking about interesting topics, to steer them away from the sort of, you know, the perennials?
God, I loathed parties. I was diary editor for 12 years. And for those sort of things, I used to send these very eager little elves, as I call them, out. And I would generally tell them to be honest about where you're from and ask people, you know, what are you up to? What are you doing? For me, I preferred dinners and lunches. I was a great luncher. Then you can hear what they're saying and also the chat can flow. So I've had lunch with Rachel Reeves a couple of times and actually, you know, found her quite pleasant. We didn't talk about interest rates at all. I think
did you talk about chess, Patrick?
My young former deputy, Grant Tucker, who was wonderful. Grant, you could stick in a room and chat to everyone. And I remember at one party at the Tory conference, he saw Philip Hammond, who was then the defence secretary. And he said, what shall I ask him? And flippantly, I said, I'll just go and ask him what his favourite gun is. And he did. As icebreakers go, I got a rather odd look.
What were the weirdest topics that people raised with you when you were at parties as a diary editor?
Probably complaining about something I'd written. Lots of complaining about other people. So I suppose if they're in a room, people can be quite bitchy. And that's to be encouraged. But also, I mean, I ask them what they've been watching on television and just see if that can then sort of meander. What I like are the conversations that start off on one trajectory and then you suddenly say, oh, that reminds me of, and that reminds me of that. And suddenly you're exchanging trivia and nuggets and anecdotes. And that's what I loved more, was an anecdote.
So start shallow and then go deep. Is that your pivot?
So, I mean, if you were to sort of a book launch or something like that, you might start about the book, but then you say, oh, did you read about this to do with something else? And they would suddenly say... There was always a danger, though, that you forget where you are. And on one occasion, there was a party at the Design Museum, and Peter Mandelson was there. And my other deputy, Jack, said to him, oh, what brings you here? And Mandelson rather coldly said, I'm the director of the museum.
Yeah, we should all have briefings before we go to parties, all parties, I definitely think. But on these topics that the Times has talked about today, Patrick, have you talked about any of them at a party yet this year? I mean, there's a good selection here. There's mansion tax, which, you know, Jennifer Aniston's new boyfriend. I mean, it's quite broad. Obviously, the Ozempic chat, whether you've got ADHD or not. Bad dog behaviour. I can imagine you being quite good on that topic.
Dogs are a great... And that's the wonderful Jilly Cooper, God bless her. Because I remember talking to her once and about the afterlife, which looked pertinent now. And aww, she said she hoped that in the afterlife there would just be a big pack of dogs scampering across the lawn towards her. That gives you a story, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And Patrick, you mentioned that you like to look forward in terms of party chat. So, you know, as you're on the social circuit for the next couple of weeks, what are the topics that you want to and think we should be looking forward to talking about parties? What's coming up that you'd like to discuss?
Well, I want people to tell me what to look for. I want to hear good news. We've had such a miserable time. So I want to say, you know, if you've got any good holidays, are you going to read any good coming books? What are you looking forward to? And that's, you know, you can't prescribe that. You just then really hope they say, I'm going off to go spelunking in Thailand or something like that. But you're right about Manjaro, actually. It's not the conversations you have with people who are on it. It's the conversations you have about people who might be...
Exactly. There's an awful lot of speculation, yeah. And you can watch the canapé table for evidence. Absolutely. Patrick, it's lovely to speak to you and I look forward to bumping into you at many parties over the next few weeks and discussing everything except Rachel Reeves. I can't wait. That's Patrick Kidd, who is the former Times diary editor and contributor here at Times Radio and at The Times. Now, coming up a year after the revolution in Syria, could it fall back into the abyss? That's after the news with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine cannot do without either Europe or America as he meets Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz in Downing Street. Macron says the Russian economy is starting to suffer, especially after the latest sanctions. Merz says he's sceptical about details in documents coming from the US. The Prime Minister says unity is vital.
We stand with Ukraine and if there's to be a ceasefire, it needs to be a just and lasting ceasefire. And that's why it's so important that we repeatedly set out the principle that matters about Ukraine are for Ukraine.
The former footballer Joey Barton's been given a 6-month suspended sentence. It's for comments he posted on social media about football pundits Eni Aluko and Lucy Ward and the broadcaster Jeremy Vine. The 43-year-old was found guilty of 6 counts of sending a grossly offensive electronic communication with intent to cause distress or anxiety. And a nurse who objected to sharing a female changing room with a transgender doctor has won a claim for harassment. Sandy Peggy was suspended after complaining about sharing with Dr. Beth Upton, a male who identifies as a female at Victoria Hospital in Kirkcaldy. She then brought a tribunal case against NHS Fife. Allegations of discrimination, indirect discrimination and victimisation were dismissed. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly. So must we. £50 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £50, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Good afternoon, it's 2.33 here on Times Radio with me, Jane Mulcairns, in for Jane and Fee this afternoon. I'm here with you until 4, and then taking over will be John Pienaar. Good afternoon, John.
Hi, Jane. Hi. So, the talk's going on in Downing Street with the leaders of France and Germany, Kyrgyzstan with that, and, of course, Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader. They're going to be, I guess, looking at their options. Where do they go from here, which is easy to ask, and how on earth do you answer that question, especially when Donald Trump is again sort of leaning back from Ukraine, looks more like blaming Ukraine again for the war in Ukraine rather than Russia and Putin. So they're looking at those options, no doubt wondering, are we getting close to the point where President Trump walks away from the whole thing? So we're looking at that. I'm talking to Alicia Vasilenko, who's a Ukrainian MP, and also to Peter Ricketts, who's a former British National Security Advisor. And later on, taking into that, putting it against the background of that astonishing document, I think it was astonishing, on Friday, the US National Security Paper, which spoke about, well, essentially about America stepping back and away from being a pillar of the Western alliance. And if you read Matthew Syed on this at the weekend, he described it as essentially a prospectus for a Trumpian global extortion racket. And that was just one of the things that he had to say that was extraordinarily condemnatory. So I'm going to be talking about that, maybe debating some of it through with Greg Swenson, who's the head of the Republicans abroad here in Britain, and Daniel Freed, who's a former American ambassador to Poland. Lots else on the programme, but I'm talking to a bit later on Edward Adu. He was a pupil of the murdered headmaster Philip Lawrence, about the influence that teacher had on him.
John, do you know what time, or if at all this afternoon, we're going to be hearing about what's coming out of Downing Street in those talks?
No, I don't believe there's any sort of media event plan. No, okay. Big sort of leader press conference. They may have things to say individually when they come out, and hopefully that will give us a bit of a clue as to what's going on. Either way, we'll be watching and we'll certainly be talking.
Absolutely brilliant. Thanks so much, John. That's John Pienaar, who will be here with you from 4. Now, it is a year to the day since Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad fled, and 2.6 million Syrians have now gone back to their homes. Almost a third of the country's population fled abroad during the war, though the majority of those who've returned have come from camps inside Syria. The revolution provided hope to many Syrians, but a piece in the Times today covers the deadly legacy of almost 14 years of war and sectarianism. Emma Beals is a journalist, senior advisor to the European Institute of Peace, and the co-founder of Syria in Context. Good afternoon, Emma.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here, Emma, on this day, on this anniversary, and giving us your insights. Now, Emma, I just want to start with, you know, what happened a year ago. The fall of the Assad regime was regarded as such a positive. But a year on, what is the picture in Syria?
It's still pretty positive. I mean, obviously, there's some huge caveats around that, and I can sort of walk through those very quickly. But, I mean, At its heart, it is still an enormous miracle, both in terms of Assad being gone, and particularly since we were able to see that really brutal, grim reality of just how barbaric that regime was and just how brutally they had been treating the population. But also in terms of, you know, I like to sort of look at it as a leap of faith. Because he fell so quickly in those last days after a really long and brutal war, there was, for the most part, a sort of collective security undertaken by Syrians of all sort of ethnic and religious backgrounds and political affiliations to a large extent, obviously with notable exceptions. But, you know, people got up and went to work, and there's a huge number of people trying to make this work. And that's the positive part. If you'd asked just about anybody that worked on Syria or was Syrian, whether where we are today was possible after such a long period of time, they would have have thought that you were a little bit crazy to even suggest it. So we do have to hold on to the fact that we still are in a narrative of miracles. That doesn't mean that it's easy or that everything is good. There have been, you know, a lot of issues in terms of reintegrating some areas of the country. So the Kurdish northeast, the conversations there have kind of stalled about how that will reintegrate to the central state. Some of the other areas that are have, you know, particular ethical or religious affiliations have or sectarian elements have been having challenges of security or negotiating what their role in the future of Syria is going to look like. And there have obviously been far too many deaths and too much violence around that. But there is also a huge number of positive signs about the direction of travel and a whole lot of people trying to make it work because, you know, they don't have a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the biggest challenges facing the new Syrian government today? I mean, this report in the Times does talk about, you know, daily killings and some chaos and sort of some cities, including Homs, you know, being potentially on the threshold of a sort of violent collapse.
I think, yeah, Homs is obviously a very important a place to keep an eye out on in terms of how that plays out over the coming months and years and what it means for security. Because it's one thing to kind of have these regions in the coast or in Sweda with these fractious relationships with the central state. But somewhere like Homs, which is a major city, is obviously a very different situation. And the real challenge for the new authorities is how to balance those questions of civic peace and justice, right? Because there are elements of the population who have, you know, real and genuine fears about their future under a joined Syria. There are also a huge amount of crimes and a whole lot of killing that has gone on where large parts of the population are still looking for justice and trying to balance how to deliver that justice, how to make the people who have suffered feel that they have been heard, that their loved ones' legacies and lives mattered without it becoming a quest for revenge, you know, perceived or real against the elements of the population that were involved in perpetuating those crimes. And that balance is the really, really difficult hard work that is going well in some places and really not so well in others.
Yeah, I mean, the piece today mentions the mass graves that being dug up in an attempt to find bodies of 100,000 people who are missing since 2011. And I guess it's very hard, isn't it, under a new regime to try to work out how you get some accountability for those deaths.
Well, exactly. I mean, and there's two parts to it, right? The families want to know what happened to their loved ones because they still haven't found out. I mean, they presumed at the point that their loved ones did not come out of the prisons when the doors were opened that they had perished in those places. But they still have not had that confirmation from the documents that the regime had kept or from the exhumation of their remains in those mass graves. And so for those people, there's still a lot of grief and there's a lot of unanswered questions. And they haven't seen that widespread accountability of the people who were involved in that security sector, obviously in the ranks below the regime itself who have fled to places like Moscow. But then you the problem with that is that you have, whenever there's these trigger moments of potential violence, you do have people wanting to take matters into their own hands. So you'll have a altercation based on, you know, sometimes small events, sometimes much larger. But then you do have some of the population who will jump in on those, seeking out their own forms of justice because they don't feel like it has been received. And then, of course, that then adds to the fear and the perception or the experience of a lack of justice from those communities, because obviously parts of the Alawite community didn't have anything to do with what the regime was up to, although some did. And so these things are really, really difficult to balance on both sides to try to stop that revenge attacks and to try to stop the sectarian cycles, but in a way that also acknowledges that huge amounts of harm have been done over the last 14 years.
Absolutely. Emma, you mentioned Moscow. Bashar al-Assad is in exile in Russia. Is there any prospects of him ever trying to return, do you think?
Well, I think where that goes is an interesting one. Whether the Russians would give him up at some point in exchange for pursuing their own interests, or whether that's just not something that they would do. There's also other cronies around him that fled to Russia as well. He obviously didn't tell many people and fled. He really looked out for himself in much the same way that we expected he would. You know, he didn't have much interest in doing right by just about anybody, including those who had helped him stay in power. But some of those people fled to Russia as well. So you have, you know, cousins and high-level security officials as well who would probably be pursued through either international or Syrian justice one day, but whether or not they can extradite those high-level officials remains to be seen.
Mm. And before I let you go, I'm just on the new leader front. Ahmed al-Shara, he's a former leader of al-Qaeda, but he seems to have made a very successful job of kind of launching a charm offensive against Western with Western leaders. And, you know, he seems to be getting on well with Trump, getting the US sanctions against Syria eased, sort of turning up at international conferences. Can that hold?
Well, this is what remains to be seen. You know, how does this look in practice? I don't think that his, you know, people are warming to him because he seems like a thoughtful person. He's read a lot about other contexts that have gone through conflict and how they have recovered. He has some pretty strong views around what may or may not work in that regard. He's, you know, said to sort of, he was grilling Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart, for example, about the Westminster political system, right? So he's interested in learning, and that's not really something that you can fake, and people are responding well to that. And I think they're also responding well to the fact that he does seem genuinely interested in doing the right thing for his people, whether or not we would agree, myself or obviously Syrians' perceptions being the most important, as to the means by which he would undertake that. That's a different story. But I think that most people are generally attuned to the idea that he is trying to do the right thing for his people as he sees fit. I guess the big questions is going to be, as things start to loosen up, I mean, once there is more economic activity, once you can have more electricity, once you can have more civic space, which is all sort of gradually happening, then you get to the really important questions around how much democracy are we going to have? How much choice are people going to have? And there were recent polls last week that sort of said he had 81% support among the population. So he still is genuinely very popular and would almost certainly win an election tomorrow by quite a significant margin. And he's just going to have to deliver over the next 4 years, I think it is, before there's tagged to be a proper election, in order to maintain that level of popularity. So whether or not he can himself translate these promises that he's making and sort of the promise that is coming out of this moment into genuine popular governance is something that we'll all need to watch.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for your time this afternoon, Emma. It's great to have your insights. That's Emma Beals, who is a journalist, senior advisor to the European Institute of Peace and the co-founder of Syria in Context. Coming up, have English and Scottish fans already been priced out of going to the World Cup? And is it sexist to offer a woman a smaller dinner? It is 2:45 here on Times Radio with me, Jane Mulcairns, and with Wix, where you can book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
This Christmas, Times Radio and Thomas Fudge's Biscuits invite you to experience a Yuletide trip you'll never forget. Search Times Radio competitions and enter to win an enchanting three-night Christmas getaway for two in either Vienna, Prague or Copenhagen, courtesy of Thomas Fudge's Remarkable Biscuits. This delicious experience includes flights, luxury hotel accommodation, dinner and £500 spending money. Celebrate Christmas in style with Times Radio and Thomas Fudge's. Hats off to Remarkable Biscuits.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
Every investor has a future in mind.
Whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. It's 12 minutes to three here on Times Radio with me, Jane Mulkerins, in for Jane and Fee this afternoon. Now, England and Scotland fans are bracing themselves for an almighty spend to attend next summer's World Cup, which of course is being held across the US, Canada and Mexico. The tournament is set to be the biggest ever. It's been expanded from 32 teams to 48. It would be played across 39 days, which is 10 days longer than the last World Cup in Qatar, and will total 104 games compared to just 64 in 2022. And with that, everything else is getting bigger too. Though many of the ticket prices haven't been finalised, the games are expected to be the most expensive in history, with the cheapest tickets released so far for the opening match coming in at a whopping £417, which is, wait for it, £376 more than the Qatar opener. Well, joining me now to discuss this and just get really angry is broadcast journalist and Premier League commentator Toby Gillis. Good afternoon, Toby.
We don't have to get angry, but we probably will.
Toby, what's the main factor making things so ridiculously expensive in this tournament?
I've got one word for you. It's America.
Yeah.
It really is that simple. And what we should say is that, you know, if you go to any sport, any top-level sport in America, it's blooming expensive. Mm. Like, it really is. And of course, you know, I mean, to a degree, the fans there can afford it. I mean, if you look at the article that you're quoting from in the Times, it mentions that the average salary for a full-time job is £8,000 more for an American than it is for someone from the
UK.
And
I would say that's actually a conservative estimate.
Possibly.
I would say, you know, it incrementally increases as you go up the brackets. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it is something that perhaps they would expect, but you know, we come from a relatively wealthy country. I mean, you think about nations like Haiti or Uzbekistan or the Cape Verde Islands who have qualified, or Curacao, who have qualified for this expanded World Cup. And they're going to have to deal with it as well. But you mentioned the ticket prices there. You know, that is part of it, of course. Mm. To a degree, they've done what they can to keep teams in what they call the Eastern or the Central or the Western part.
But let's
it's
talk
three
about
countries
that,
and America's quite big.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, the idea that they've kept them in the same region. So the England group games are in Boston, New Jersey and Dallas.
Yes.
Which are, you know, well, Boston and New Jersey, okay, you could probably do that in a day, and it's 5 hours on a train, maybe.
Yeah.
Probably about 6 hours
driving. It's 2,000 miles
Dallas,
between the three
Dallas
games.
It's 2,000 miles.
2,000 miles.
I mean, unless they are spread out over days, so you could have a nice road trip. Mm. Scotland games are in Boston and Miami, equally spread. So why are they spread so geographically? It's basically, the USA is one region for this. Mexico is another region and Canada is another region.
No, like for example, Toronto counts as the eastern section.
Right.
So you could potentially be playing a game in Toronto
Miami.
And then in New York or whatever. So they're, you know, they are, whichever countries they're in, you know, there's no team that's going to play solely in Mexico, for example, possibly with the exception of the Mexicans. I'd have to check that, to be honest with you. So yeah, you know, the ticket prices that you mentioned are extraordinary. I mean, just for an example, they've got these sort of four tiers of pricing that they've released for sort of general admission tickets. So that's not necessarily if you bought through the FA and you say, I want to follow England throughout the tournament. However, if you add all these general admission tickets together, say you wanted to go to all of the England games on the cheapest category, the category four, £2,363. That's almost £2,000 more than if you'd done the same in category Qatar in 2022.
That's just for tickets.
And by the way, the public I know it's a much smaller place, but the public transport alongside that in Qatar, free.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's
It's going to be very, very difficult for people to afford to do it in any way on the cheap, aren't they? I mean, and then you've obviously got the cost of hotel rooms I mean, transatlantic flights, internal flights, or driving. And then, I mean, I have to say, as someone who spends quite a lot of time in the US because of friends and family and work, you know, you're looking at a beer is probably going to cost you $15. Mm. A glass of wine is probably going to cost you $20.
Cheapest flight currently from Scotland to Boston, where they play their first two games, £1,054. You know, and that's before you've then got to try and get yourself to Miami as well. The cheapest rooms, the rooms that are being charged for within a 5 mile radius of the stadium in Dallas where England are playing, currently at four times the price of a normal summer. Mm. For a single room, £1,000 within 5 miles of the stadium.
Do you think we are going to see far fewer British and Scottish fans, English and Scottish fans, attending the games this year?
I think that people will attend fewer matches. Mm. Those that are inclined to go under any normal circumstance will go, okay, I'm going to take a hit of, say, $3,000, whatever, for the first two games, and then I'll go, and then maybe if we get to the semi-finals, that's the opportunity to then go back. I think we'll see fewer people do all of the games. Mm. I can't see England fans not heading out and filling out the England matches because, football is so ingrained in us. Scotland have waited over 10,000 days since they were last in a World Cup in 1990. They've had time to save. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, this was always a controversial decision, having these tournaments across more than one country, particularly when one of the nations is the US, which is already so vast. And the one thing that everybody forgets in all of this, because we all get caught up, those of us who are big sports fans get caught up in wanting to be there and wanting to enjoy the tournament, is the environmental cost. You know, people are going to be taking flights, to not just to get there, but flights internally. You know, the players will be jetting around all over the place. And, you know, it is a logistical nightmare, a financial nightmare, and an environmental nightmare. But equally, if football wants to continue growing, then the US has to be heavily, heavily involved in that. And of course, now is the time from FIFA's point of view with Donald Trump involved, because, you know, he's so happy to embrace these sorts of things when he gets the positive press for it.
Yeah, and he gets some awards for it in the meantime. I will say also, the US is very good at putting on a show when you go to sport.
Will be magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, when you go to a basketball match, it's not just the sport that you're there for. You get several different dancing troupes. You know, you get pandas being fired out of cannons, you get kiss cam, you get everything. It's a spectacle. Mm. It's not just, you know, and then you take Americans to a Premier League game and they just, it's quite boring. 90 minutes of football.
I'll tell you what else struck me today, something that I just spotted just before I came down here, and I think you'll really enjoy this. There is a game in Seattle that had been for quite some time designated as a Pride Day, you know, celebrating all around the LGBTQ+ community. That match, it turns out, is going to be played between Iran and Egypt. Wow. Two nations with amongst the most draconian anti-gay rules that there are. So, I mean, you know, I don't know whether that will change, but at this moment in time, that match is designated a Pride match. And maybe that is an opportunity to help the world grow in a different way.
Exactly. It's all an opportunity, Toby. Yes. Thank you. And I guess you'll be asking for a commission to be sent out there to report on it.
I would absolutely love to go there, yes.
Great to see you, Toby. Thanks so much. That's Toby Gillis, who's a broadcast journalist and also a Premier League commentator. Now, ticket prices are getting larger, but portions for women might be getting smaller. According to the head of the government's obesity initiative, Professor Naveed Sattar, the suggestion is that there should be at least two different portion sizes for ready-to-eat products, like sandwiches, microwave meals, restaurant meals, even cakes, to account for the fact that we women have a lower daily calorie intake need. Well, here to discuss this is the Times columnist Polly Vernon. Good afternoon, Polly.
Hello, Jane.
Lovely to talk to you this afternoon, Polly. Now, I know as a noted feminist, people might expect you to be up in arms about this. Are you cross?
No, I'm actually not. I mean, I'm not sure I'm a noted feminist. I'd say I'm a disputed feminist. but I understand as a feminist that I technically should be up in arms. But also as a feminist, I'm not, because obesity is a big issue and it is a painful issue. And as it turns out, particularly for women. So I sort of think anything that helps us keep a grip on our weight is not necessarily a bad or unfeminist thing.
Do you think this could actually impact the obesity numbers, though, in the UK? I mean, do you think basically just offering women the opportunity to have smaller portions, would it be taken seriously?
I think as part of a greater effort to nudge us towards making better choices, it could, like in, you know, as part of a vast mix, as part of a reframing of food and how we consume, yeah, I can see it as being significant. I think that portion sizes is such a massive issue, and we have no grip on them whatsoever. I say in the piece that I think we sort of think there's some greater force at work that's making sure that those portion sizes mean something and that they're meaningful, and that the sandwich we pick up from Pret or wherever actually does, you know, it is kind of worth a third of our calorific consumption for the day. But there's absolutely no monitoring of that whatsoever. Mm. That's really arbitrary and generally far too big for women and men, actually.
Well, it's interesting about the portion size thing, because we, you know, Toby and I were just talking about the US, and things are very expensive, including going out to dinner, but the portion sizes there are huge. But there's a real culture in taking half your dinner home in a doggy bag. You know, the sort of boxing it up to go is a real culture, which we don't have here yet. We sort of still have that idea that if you go out to dinner and you're spending money, you should clear your plate.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things going on. There's first of all, there's a money issue going on, which is now more than ever in the midst of a cost of living crisis. That idea of waste feels even more kind of compelling to avoid at all costs. But I also think there's a sort of rudeness thing going on. You know, it's like having the waiter go, "Is everything okay, madam, with your meal?" And you're like, yeah, I'm just trying to not put on loads of weight. So I think those two are quite strong combining forces that do compel us to eat more than we should. And when you eat more than you should most days of the week, or even half a days of the week, that's gonna end up costing you.
Now, some people are gonna say, Polly, this is just nanny state gone mad. Is there anything that bad with a bit of nanny state?
I'm a little bit prone, I say. I think what has gone mad is our idea of what food even is, and, you know, what is a reasonable amount of food to eat. We're really up against it in terms of calories, in terms of what is being offered us all the time, what is being marketed at us really, really hard. So I don't mind a little bit of nanny state in that respect. We need something to recalibrate our idea of what it is okay to eat and how much it is okay to eat.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon, Polly. It's always great to speak to you. That's Polly Vernon, who is a Times columnist and who, like me, doesn't mind a bit of nanny state. Mary just says on the text, "Don't people take home their leftovers? A dinner out can give me lunch and dinner for the next day." I couldn't agree more, Mary. Sometimes some of us keep a little bit from the canteen because they give us quite a lot here too.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you're listening to Jane Mulcairns on Times Radio, in today for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. Up next, Keir Starmer, who's Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky at Downing Street, will speak to a Ukrainian MP and hear why Donald Trump is hitting the road. Plus, we'll talk Christmas scams in Money Matters and we'll throw open the doors of our literary salon. But first, it's the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine cannot do without either Europe or America as he meets Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz in Downing Street. Macron says the Russian economy is starting to suffer, especially after the latest sanctions. Merz says he's sceptical about details in documents coming from the United States. A 7.6 magnitude earthquake off the northeastern coast of Japan has prompted a tsunami warning. Waves as high as 3 metres could now hit that coast, according to Japan's meteorological agency. A nurse who objected to sharing a female changing room with a transgender doctor has won a claim for harassment. More details from Times Radio's Laura Cook.
Sandy Peggy was suspended after complaining about having to share changing facilities with Dr. Beth Upton at Victoria Hospital in Kirkcaldy on Christmas Eve 2023. She was placed on special leave after Upton, a male who identifies as a female, made an allegation of bullying and harassment and cited concerns about patient care. Peggy had brought a tribunal case against NHS Fife, citing the Equality Act 2010. While a claim of harassment was upheld, allegations of discrimination, indirect discrimination and victimisation were dismissed. Peggy says she's beyond relieved and delighted, and the last 2 years have been agonising.
The former footballer Joey Barton has been given a six-month suspended sentence for sending offensive social media posts. He targeted two female pundits, Eni Aluko and Lucy Ward, and the broadcaster Jeremy Vine. Judge Andrew Menery says his post caused harm in a number of ways.
It's plain that each of your victims experienced very substantial distress and anxiety as a direct consequence of your actions.
Barton must also complete 200 hours of unpaid work and pay £23,000 in legal costs. The Conservative leader says an inquiry into grooming gangs must be speeded up. Kemi Badenoch's party wants the background of the gangs to be examined and a two-year time limit placed on the inquiry.
This is a specific issue about the scale of a potential cover-up. Where did local councils and police social services fail? And what were the cultural, religious and ethnic factors that might have made this scandal so much worse for certain victims?
Essex Police has confirmed it's looking at claims that Reform UK overspent on Nigel Farage's general election campaign in Clacton last year. Documents submitted by a former party councillor, Richard Everett, allegedly show the party spent over £20,000 more than allowed in the constituency. Reform denies doing so. And Paramount has launched a hostile bid for Warner Brothers, challenging Netflix. It's offering $105 billion. Netflix has offered $72 billion. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for a Times News briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. Today with me, Jane Mulcairns, keeping the studio seats warm for Jane and Fee on this wet and windy Monday. Thank you for your company this afternoon. It is great to be with you and it is great to have you here with us. It's 3 minutes past three here in London, and coming up in this hour, as President Zelensky meets with European leaders here in London, we'll cross to Ukraine to speak to Ukrainian MP Alexei Goncharenko, and we will find out why Donald Trump is firing up the MAGA minibus and holding his first rally in 5 months tomorrow. And it is a Monday, which means it's our regular money slot with Adam Sage and our literary salon today with the Times literary editor, deputy literary editor, I apologise, Laura Hackett. But now, any peace deal in Ukraine will need hard-edged security guarantees. That is according to Keir Starmer, who today is hosting Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky in Downing Street, along with French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, who are at the talks in number 10. The meeting came as the US piles on the pressure for a quick deal with Russia, with Donald Trump accusing Zelensky of not reading the latest draft deal.
We've been speaking to Ukrainian leaders, including Zelensky, President Zelensky. And I have to say that I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people love it, but he hasn't. Russia's fine with it. Russia, I guess, would rather have the whole country when you think of it. But Russia is, I believe, fine with it. But I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it.
That was, of course, Donald Trump. For more, we are joined by two guests here, Ukrainian MP Alexei Goncharenko and also the Russia expert Keir Giles, who's director of the Conflict Studies Research Centre. Good afternoon to you both.
Hello, good afternoon. Hello.
Alexei, just coming to you first today. From a Ukrainian perspective, what do today's talks in London need to produce?
Well, that's a very good question. First, we need to understand how really European leaders and British leader are going to support Ukraine in this situation. Because the situation is really very difficult. Russia is attacking on the front line, destroying energy. For your understanding, now in Ukraine, in most of the cities, 14, 18 hours per day, there is no electricity. 14, 18 hours. So very difficult. At the same time, we see the pressure from the United States about peace, new deal, and we need peace, but some of the conditions are very hard for us, which are proposed. And at the same time, we hear a lot of talking from our European colleagues and partners, coalition of willing, but sometimes, with all respect, it looks more like coalition of talking. There is still no decision about seizing of Russian frozen assets, no decision about sending troops to Ukraine, not to fight on the front line, but for some missions in the rear. But even this decision has not been made. Europe continues to buy Russian gas, and so on. So all these makes our position very, very difficult.
Mm. On that note, Alexei, Keir Starmer said hard-edged security guarantees is something that the peace deal will need to include. What does that mean to you?
For me, it is a treaty with the United States, security treaty ratified by U.S. Congress. Because unfortunately, 31 years ago, we signed Budapest Memorandum with the United States and United Kingdom. Where are these guarantees now? It was just a paper like we found. Then we signed some security deal with President Biden without ratification in U.S. Congress. Now that's again the paper and nothing more. So we need a real treaty with a ratification in U.S. Congress. And Europe can also make its own contribution to this. But again, it should be a real steps, not a talking.
We keep hearing repeated reports of gradual losses on the ground by Ukraine, Alexei, even if that comes at a huge cost to Russia. I mean, from where we stand now, you know, nearly 4 years into the war, what is the realistic best possible ending to that war?
The best realistic possible ending now is to freeze the war on the current lines, meaning that part of our territories will be controlled by Russia, but not recognizing it as Russian, but in the status of illegally occupied. And at the same time, we will need to have security guarantees that we just spoke with you about. Mm. And then we will need to have money to rebuild the country. And the source of this money should be Russian frozen assets. Mm. That's, I think, best realistic scenario for Ukraine and for Europe, because here we are absolutely in the same boat today.
Yeah, the stalemate has gone on for a very long time, hasn't it? And I'm sure that's something that Ukraine feels deeply. Keir, just coming to you, the messaging from the US is that there are just a few small things left to decide with this deal. How true is that?
We have no way of knowing how true that is because we haven't seen the texts of what is being discussed. The last version of a potential set of surrender terms was the so-called 28-point plan that Russia put forward and then the United States attempted to enforce on Ukraine. Since then, we're told some of the unenforceable and impossible conditions in there have been clawed back, but we just don't know what is under discussion in these two parallel tracks, parallel conversations between the United States and Russia, between Ukraine and the United States, and now, presumably, a back brief to European leaders from Zelensky about what exactly is under discussion. So it may be that after all of these times when President Trump has said peace is around the corner, it might be inching closer towards actually being true, but we've no evidence to judge that by so far.
Mm. I mean, it does feel a little bit like it's sort of this constant dance that keeps being done, doesn't it? An unbalanced deal comes from the US with a lot of threats. The Europeans work to kind of make it more positive for Ukraine, and then Russia turns it down. I mean, how long do you think that dance can continue to go on for? And how much of it is performative on both sides?
Well, you're quite right that this is not the first time. This is now the third iteration we've been around exactly this sequence. So first in February, shortly after Donald Trump arrived in office. Then in August, after the Anchorage summit between Putin and Trump. And on each occasion, it is the Russian terms that are being imposed by the United States. And then there's a diplomatic scramble to try to limit the damage of what has been done. And of course, on each occasion, Russia succeeds in normalizing some of the things that it's demanding and having them accepted as de facto points for a peace plan, like, for example, this European endorsement that there should be limits on the size of the Ukrainian armed forces. That's a huge victory for Russia by means of this process. Mm. But the time when Ukraine will agree to this, will agree to these catastrophic terms, has always been under the same conditions. If Ukraine understands that accepting a disastrous peace settlement is less catastrophic than fighting on, then, of course, they have to accept. But that time is a long way off. Mm. Russia's done an exceptionally good job of convincing people around the world and apparently in the White House that Russian victory is inevitable, so you may as well speed it up. But that, in fact, is far from the objective truth.
Mm. Keir, the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., said this weekend that he thinks there's a serious chance that his father could walk away from the peace talks. A two-part question for you, really. I mean, how realistic do you think that is? Or is that just another threat to exert more pressure on Ukraine to sort of give in? And if he did walk away, where would that leave Ukraine?
Well, that too is something that has not changed throughout the whole of this year since the arrival of Donald Trump. And it's what exactly is meant by walk away. If it is a case of benign neglect, if it's washing the United States' hand of the conflict and Donald Trump takes no further interest, but the current situation persists where European allies are allowed to buy weapons for Ukraine, there's some continuing degree of intelligence support, and effectively the United States pays no further attention, that's better than the United States repeatedly taking these offers from Moscow of a set of surrender terms and trying to strong-arm Ukraine into accepting them. If, on the other hand, it's the United States walking away altogether, not just from Ukraine, but from European defense and security, and saying no further support of any kind, that's a very different situation. And then, of course, that is deep and serious trouble for the entire continent. But that's something for which European leaders should have been preparing for a long time now, because this was a very clearly visible situation that was arising even before Donald Trump arrived in office. There's been no excuse for not being ready for the worst case scenario.
Talking about the worst case scenario, but what's the best case scenario from a Ukrainian perspective? I mean, Alexei was just sort of talking about what he thinks is a realistic best possible ending to the war. You know, standing back as a director for Conflict Studies Research Centre, what do you think is the realistic best possible ending to the war?
But that depends entirely, unfortunately, not on Ukraine, but on Ukraine's partners and backers. Mm. We've heard from Keir Starmer again today that, quote, we stand with Ukraine. The key is not just saying the words, but actually doing something. And that, as Alexei Kantarenko just explained, is what has been missing. The Europeans that supposedly do understand that Ukraine is the front line of the defense of the whole of Europe have not turned a coalition of the willing discussion into being willing to actually do anything. They've not inserted themselves into this conversation about the future defense of Ukraine and therefore about their own future in a way that's meaningful. So naturally, they continue to be blindsided by the United States taking the initiative. Mm. What we haven't seen in Europe is leadership to grip the problem and actually insert Europe into this conversation on its own terms.
Do you think there's a realistic possibility of sending troops to Ukraine?
Eventually, they may have to be. But then that, too, is a conversation that simply has not changed over time. European countries understood perfectly well at the first iteration of these peace talks that in order to send a reassurance force into Ukraine, it needed to be a force that could withstand Russian attempts to eject it. Because, of course, if you are there, Russia will see you as a target, and the worst possible thing would be to then withdraw under Russian pressure. That's worse than not going in at all. But what we've seen is two things. First of all, Keir Starmer changing his mind very shortly after saying that British troops must be in the lead and saying, well, actually, no, we can't do it without the Americans. And second, repeated iterations of European powers getting together supposedly to work out what they can do, but never actually coming up with a solution that seems to be implemented. So it's all hypothetical at the moment. Mm-hmm. Just like the conversations about what might be in the peace terms, we don't know what we're talking about. So all of this coalition of the willing talk is only for after the conflict has ended. And if there isn't a more proactive intervention, it will be ended on Russian terms, because that's what the United States seems determined to do.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for your time this afternoon. That's Ukrainian MP Alexei Goncharenko and the Russia expert Keir Giles, who is director of the Conflict Studies Research Centre. And John Pienaar will, of course, have much more on that story of the peace talks today in Downing Street on his show here from 4 o'clock. Coming up, we'll discuss the latest accusations faced by Nigel Farage. It is 3:15. I'm Jane Mulcairns on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrund and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective, and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth, and the joy that meets you there. Silver Sea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
A 9 a.m. brekkie of Co-op chocolate chip panettone, gingerbread and maple mince pies on the bus, giant cinnamon knots in your glove compartment,
and plenty more of our irresistible food range to choose from. Why? Because Christmas. Co-op. Owned by you, right by you.
Selected stores subject to availability. Co-op Group Food Stores only. See co-op.co.uk for details.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Good afternoon. It's 17 minutes past three here on Times Radio. We were just discussing the Ukrainian talks being held in Downing Street today between Keir Starmer and Volodymyr Zelensky. And central, of course, to any hopes of finding a peace between Ukraine and Russia is President Donald Trump. Well, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and author of The Making of Donald Trump, David K. Johnson, joins me now. Good afternoon, David.
Hello, Jane.
Thank you so much for being here this afternoon. David, what do you make of the president's current approach to the war between Russia and Ukraine? He had quite a lot to say about Volodymyr Zelensky today.
Well, Donald's view of the world is that might makes right. And in fact, the U.S. government last Thursday night quietly put out its latest national security statement, and it is about going back to a system of great powers with satellites and subordinate powers that have to do with the great powers say. And it's also, though not relevant perhaps to this, explicitly white supremacist. So Donald very much, you know, has an affinity for the Russians who have been courting him for four decades. The plan he's putting forward right now, of course, is largely a Russian plan.
Yeah, it's certainly been very well received by Russia, hasn't it, this national security strategy?
Well, I think there's a reason for that, Jane, and that is it's in the interests of Vladimir Putin to simply extend this, to say, well, we'll talk, we'll meet, because this is a war of attrition. And over a long slog, incompetent as the Russian military has proved to be, and despite enormous casualties on the battlefield, over the long haul, Russia will be able to wear down Ukraine. So this is just another stalling tactic so they can continue this war of aggression and attrition.
I mean, it does seem when you look at Donald Trump's sort of behavior in terms of, you know, who he's kind of trying to have conversations with, that he makes his mind kind of based on the last person he spoke to.
Yes. Yeah, Donald is absolutely notorious for the last person he talked to. And the reason for that is that Donald, and I've known him for almost 40 years, is unbelievably, appallingly ignorant. You know, when Putin says that Russia is the mother country here, and the fact is that 1,000 years ago, Kyiv was a thriving city and Moscow was two or three huts out in the forest, Donald doesn't know any of that, and he doesn't care. In Donald's mind, when he conjures up something, that's the way it is. And Jane, if you don't accept that, well, you're fake news.
It is very interesting, though, isn't it, David? Because, you know, I think most of us remember Donald Trump saying he didn't want to get involved in foreign wars. Right. He didn't want that for America. And yet here we are. But on that note, Donald Trump is heading to Pennsylvania tomorrow for his first rally in 5 months. David, what do you see as his motivations in that?
Well, Donald's MAGA base is fracturing. We saw Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene leave. And what did she leave over? It's Trump's opposition to continuing tax credits so that roughly 17 million poor Americans will continue to have some access to health care under the Affordable Care Act that was put forth by President Barack Obama. And in addition, his refusal to come clean about the Epstein files has created another fracture within the MAGA movement. And essentially, you're seeing this movement break up into pieces based on people's interests. And of course, MAGA is a movement largely of very poorly educated people with minimal critical thinking skills. They deeply hold and believe in things, whether they really understand them or not. And when Trump says, I'll end the war in a day, the war in Ukraine or the one in Gaza, and he can't do it, when he says, I'll release all the Epstein files, and then he doesn't do it, those things, together with the practical effect that we're seeing rural hospitals and medical facilities close, and many people facing a doubling, tripling, quadrupling, even quintupling of their cost for healthcare to where they can't afford it, those things are creating real problems within the Make America Great Again movement.
And aside from just the healthcare costs, as you say, I mean, just the general cost of living in America is really stubbornly refusing to come down, isn't it? I mean, the president's blaming it all on the Biden administration. He's also claiming that petrol and eggs are now going down, and that proves that he's got a more successful economic strategy. I mean, is putting on a show in Pennsylvania, having one of these rallies, really going to convince people that he is bringing down the cost of living? Does it help shore up flagging support for someone in Donald Trump's position?
Yeah, this will be a real test because it's possible he will be booed at this rally, which he's never been. He's been booed in many places, baseball stadiums, football stadiums and the like. And it's possible that will happen here. Donald has always used these rallies to focus attention where he wants it and draw support. On the other hand, what people generally haven't seen is that many times these rallies had relatively small crowds. There were lots of empty seats, and anybody who pointed a camera to the empty seats, security would quickly rush out of the building. I actually got reporters working for me at DC Report to get film like that by shooting selfies with people, in which you then could see in the background all the empty seats. But how big the crowd is and how enthusiastic they are will be quite an interesting insight into the MAGA movement. On the other hand, if you just look at the recent voting results, including one week ago in Tennessee, Trump's movement is clearly not solidly behind him. They're not turning out. A congressional district that he had won by 22 points, the Republican won, but only by 9 points. And that means every congressperson who's a Republican has to be worried about what's going to happen to them in November of next year.
Well, on that note, David, I mean, the US is already turning its attention to next year's midterms. How much of an issue will the cost of living be in those elections?
I think it's going to be a huge issue. And the fact that Trump has shut down a number of the basic statistical indicators for the country is not helping him. He doesn't want to hear the bad news, so he just says, we're not going to have this data available. And I don't think you can trust it either at this point, unfortunately. You have to look at it the way we do data from the Russian Statistical Ministry and from China as not reliable. But cost of living is a critical issue with many, many Americans. If you're in the top 10% in America, it's at best, an annoyance. But for the vast majority of Americans, these are really crucial issues. You know, Donald claimed the other day that I've lowered drug prices 1,500%. I've yet to find a drug company paying me for the medications my doctor has me on.
Just beyond next year's midterm elections, just looking ahead to 2028, David, do we think Donald Trump really cares about succession? I mean, it seems to be very much the Donald show. He doesn't seem to be necessarily nominating an obvious successor at the moment. Do we think that, you know, the MAGA movement may end with Trump?
I don't know the MAGA movement will end. I mean, after all, we're seeing all around the world people going around and saying Hitler was right. And Hitler's been dead now for more than 80 years. I think that that movement will stay, particularly the racist elements that are the underlying core of that movement. But I also think that the Republicans have done themselves a disfavor. They are redistricting in Texas and some other states to eliminate what they think of as Democratic elected districts. The problem is that they're narrowing the margins in the solidly, overwhelmingly Republican districts. And what we saw in Tennessee tells us that that's actually an opportunity for the Democrats to win a lot of those districts because of unhappiness with Trump. Donald doesn't think long into the future. He is to any extent that he's a thinker, it's tactical. It's not strategic. And he's also, by the way, flatly said in the past, who cares what happens after you're dead?
Fair enough. Thank you so much, David, for your time this afternoon. That is David K. Johnson, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Making of Donald Trump. Now, closer to home, Essex police say they are looking into allegations that Reform UK overspent on Nigel Farage's general election campaign last year. A former member of Farage's campaign, Richard Everett, claimed the campaign went over its spending limits by thousands of pounds, but he did add that the Reform leader was unaware. Reform's Deputy Leader Richard Tice says it's an attempt at revenge.
First of all, this is by a disgruntled former councillor who was expelled from the Reform Party for allegedly inappropriate sexual behavior back in the summer. And surprise, surprise, he's now making all sorts of allegations. Well, that's a surprise.
Mr. Everett, who made the claim, does deny all allegations of inappropriate behaviour. Well, I'm joined now by Theo Usherwood, veteran political journalist and news editor for the Press Association. Good afternoon, Theo.
A very good afternoon to you, Jane.
Lovely to speak to you, Theo. We briefly outlined those allegations. If they are true, how seriously would they contravene the rules of campaign spending?
So there are quite strict rules in elections when it comes to constituency spends, how much you can spend on a campaign in a particular constituency. And the limit's set at just over £20,000. And the allegation is that Reform spent £9,000 over that particular limit. Mr. Everett initially made the claim to the Metropolitan Police, who then passed it on to Essex, because, of course, Nigel Farage's constituency is in Clacton. Reform sources are also pointing to the fact that when it comes to the statute of limitations for these particular cases of overspending, there is the 12 months has, of course, expired since that election was held in 2024, July 2024. I think more broadly, it's not necessarily the outcome of any Essex Police investigation. It is, of course, the broader narrative that Nigel Farage has or his team have behaved outside of the rules when it came to his election, and to fit that in, I suppose, with the allegations of racism from his school days, the allegations made by former class schoolmates of his at Dulwich College. And what we're seeing in the last few weeks is this ramping up of attacks against Reform. Of course, as it continues to do well in the polls, although we have seen them flatline at around 27 points.
Mm. How likely is this to be investigated, Theo?
Well, that will be a matter to find out whether the rules have in fact been broken, and I'm not privy, and I don't know if any other journalists are privy, particularly to the exact details of what Mr. Everett has in whatever it is that he's passed to, well, first the Metropolitan Police and now Essex Police. The receipts that were provided at the time of the election come underneath that threshold, I think, is around £20,600. So I'm not privy to those allegations, the exact proof that Mr. Everett does or does not have. As I said, there is of course, a broader question about the statute of limitations, about whether this can actually be investigated now that we're outside of that 12-month window that Reform says exists in this particular case. I think what Reform need to actually, and what Nigel Farage needs to be prepared for, is that we're going to see as we roll into the new year and closer towards a general election, that Reform faces not just increased scrutiny, but I think they're going to face the level of attack from not only the Labour Party, just people who've been disgruntled or adversely affected by, or felt they've been ill-treated by Reform, come to the fore. That the reality of Nigel Farage becoming Prime Minister is going to only increase the likelihood that he comes under attack and accusation from those who don't want him to be Prime Minister. And of course, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, at least for now, the Conservative Party, are going to be looking to wade in and, from their perspective, try and ensure that those attacks land. The question, and I think this is slightly different to the attacks we saw when it came to racism, because it's very difficult for you. You obviously played that excerpt from an interview with Richard Tice. But unlike last week, where we saw Nigel Farage in almost a Trumpian way flip the tables on the BBC and say, how dare you accuse me of racism when look at the programmes that you've broadcast previously. When it comes to dealing with individuals, it's harder for Nigel Farage to use those same media tactics in order to fend off those allegations.
Thank you so much, Theo. Great to speak to you as always this afternoon. That's Theo Isherwood, who is news editor for the Press Association. And as good journalists, Theo and I are never less than absolutely scrupulous with our own expenses. Coming up, we'll take a look at what should be on your reading list for 2026 and what you might like to ask for Christmas. But first, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. A nurse who objected to sharing a female changing room with a transgender doctor has won a claim for harassment. Sandy Peggy was suspended after complaining about having to share changing facilities with Dr. Beth Upton, a male who identifies as a female, at Victoria Hospital in Kirkcaldy. She then brought a tribunal case against NHS Fife. Allegations of discrimination, indirect discrimination and victimisation were dismissed. A powerful earthquake has struck off the northern coast of Japan, triggering tsunami warnings. The country's meteorological agency says the 7.6 magnitude quake could cause waves of up to 3 metres. Nuclear power plants in the region are conducting safety checks. And Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine cannot do without either Europe or America as he meets Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz in Downing Street this afternoon.
Things which are very important for today, I think unity between Europe and Ukraine, and also unity between Europe, Ukraine and the United States. There are some things which we can't manage without Americans, things which we can't manage without Europe. That's why we need to make some important decisions.
Macron said the Russian economy is starting to suffer, especially after the latest sanctions against Moscow. Merz said he is sceptical about details in documents coming from the United States. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year, we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles, whether it's your first home or your forever home. Find your dream kitchen at Wickes. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free kitchen design appointment today at wickes.co.uk.
Good afternoon, it's 25 to 4 here on Times Radio and I'm Jane Mulcairns, keeping Jane Garvey and Fee Glover's both of their seats warm today. Coming up shortly, we'll have our Literary Salon with Laura Hackett. But if you enjoy Jane and Fee on Times Radio in the afternoons, you can get even more Jane and Fee with their podcast Off Air. All of their 3:30 interviews are available in full too. They've spoken to David Olusoga, Joanna Lumley and Rick Astley, to name but three. Last week, Fee spoke to Professor Chris Van Tulleken and she asked him if he's hopeful about what future generations might do for our nutrition and health.
There are some real sources of hope. So we have, I think, a growing sense that the ultra-processed food industry isn't just similar to the tobacco industry. For a long time, it was the same industry. They were the same companies. The cigarette companies owned the big food companies that we know. And so I think we have a regulatory template that isn't identical, but we can use the same approaches. I think one of the real problems that we see in the UK is that there are financial conflicts of interest between every single institution that might regulate the ultra-processed food industry and the companies themselves, whether that's government guideline committees, scientific expert committees, academic journals, research units, our biggest food charities, our media communication centres, all of it is funded by the relatively small number of companies that feed us. So that was what we ended with tobacco first, is we said if we're going to solve this problem, put warning labels on packs and effectively tax things, you need to speak to industry, you have to understand their limitations, and food is more complicated than tobacco, but you can't have industry holding your pen while you write policy.
That was Fee speaking to Professor Chris Van Tulleken last week on Off Air. And you can download that and many, many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcast from. Now, it is 3:36 here on Times Radio, and it is a Monday, so it is time for our Literary Salon. Pop open the Quality Street tin or, you know, the Baileys. It is December. And recline with me and Laura Hackett, who is Deputy Literary Editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. Good afternoon, Laura.
Good afternoon. Lovely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So, Laura, we're getting towards the end of the year, so we're going to have one pick from this year, but otherwise we're going to forge ahead and look at next year's books. And where do you want to start?
I think let's look back first, okay, shall we? So this book, The Correspondent by Virginia Evans, it came out in April and it completely passed me by. I think a copy came into the book's cupboard and I thought, I don't fancy the look of the cover, whatever, I've got loads of things to read. And then I saw that it had become a New York Times bestseller and I thought, well, maybe I should give it another chance. I read it and it pretty much instantly became one of my favourite books of the year. And I think it's one that's like perfect for giving to people for Christmas. So yeah, I just thought, let's talk about that.
Can you briefly summarise the story for us without giving too much away to anyone who might be putting it on their Christmas list?
Yes, so it's about a woman called Sybil Van Antwerp, and she's a sort of 70-something, retired, divorced mother of two. She lives on her own in this sort of pristine, white-picketed house with beautiful roses, and she spends her days writing letters. She spent her entire life, really, writing letters to friends and family, but also to strangers, and this book is told entirely through the letters that she sends and receives. And it seems as though her life is completely settled, like this is all she's going to do forever. And then actually different people and different events come into her life and it really expands and widens in such a hopeful way. And it kind of sounds like it might not be that interesting reading someone's letters, but I was completely hooked.
But this is fiction.
Yes, it's fiction.
So it's a kind of literary technique that they've used to just sort of give a sense of the story through what she's saying to other people.
Exactly. And what's really interesting about it is sometimes she'll receive a letter from someone and it'll be 50 pages later before you can see her reply. So you're imagining what she might think about it and what her response might be. It's a really nice technique to really build up that kind of tension.
Mm. I love the idea that as the Times Deputy Literary Editor, you sometimes go into the book cupboard and think you don't fancy things. Very honest of you. Do you have that thing slightly when books come out and everybody's reading it, that you don't want to read it at the same time as other people? Because I definitely have that.
I know, and it almost feels like if everyone's talking about it, you're almost caving in to peer pressure, and it's like, well, I'm not going to read it. I mean, luckily we get sent a lot of them in advance, so sometimes I like to try and read them before everyone else has. Because also, if everyone's talking about it, you feel like your impressions are shaped by other people's. So it's quite nice, I think, to have that distance between when it's sort of everywhere and when it can just be you and the book.
Yeah, I definitely am in favour of not bandwagon jumping, but I think that's the advantage of a Kindle, because no one can see what you're reading. So when you're on the tube, nobody knows you're reading the same thing as 10 other people in the carriage. Yeah, absolutely. Laura, let's look ahead to 2026. Give me your top three book picks for 2026.
Gosh, there are lots of really interesting books coming out next year. Okay, so some I'm really excited about. Well, there's Julian Barnes's novel.
Ooh.
And he says that this is going to be his last novel. So that's a big deal. And I'm really looking forward to reading
that. Why is he saying it's going to be his last novel?
Well, I guess he's getting on a little bit now. So I think, you know, everyone else kind of retires and writers just keep going. But maybe he's just thought, you know what? This is it. I'm going to sort of end on a high.
Time for hobbies.
No.
Don't stop, Julian.
Keep going, please.
You've told us about one, but Cape Fever, by Nadia Davids. Why is that going to be something you're excited about in 2026?
So I've picked two sort of books coming out in early January, and this is one of them. It's set in the 1920s in a place which seems a bit like Cape Town, but it might not exactly be like that. And the publisher pitched it as The Safe Keep, you might remember that Yael van der Woerden novel, in South Africa. And I thought, you know, I'm a person who raved about the Safe Keep for a good year and I'm married to a South African. So it's almost like they've aimed this at me. I have to read it.
They wrote a book for you, Laura.
They wrote it just for me. And it's really interesting. It's about this young woman called Soraya, and she is an indigenous person to the land, and she goes to work as a maid for this woman, Mrs. Hatting, who is a settler. And Mrs. Hatting is a really kind of unpleasant individual. She's quite self-righteous. She's always ordering Soraya around, and you think it's going to be quite a normal tale, but then there's a real twist because Soraya pretends that she's illiterate, and then Mrs. Hatting starts thinking she's being oh so kind, writing letters to Soraya's fiance and meddling in that relationship. So it's really interesting the way that it ends up.
Interesting dynamic. I don't know Nadia Davids. Is that a big oversight on my part?
No, she has written a novel before, but I don't think it really burst through. And I'm wondering if this might be the time where a novel of hers, sometimes that happens with writers. They write and write a little bit under the radar, and then a book comes out that everyone kind of just, it sparks something. So this might be it.
Calls them an overnight success.
Exactly.
They've been writing for 20 years. Yeah. Are you a fan of a gothic sort of psychological thriller? Is that up your street?
I think, you know, when you grow up with Jane Eyre, you're always on the hunt for something a little bit like that. And this has those sorts of feelings to it. There's almost a little bit of magic. There are ghosts in it, but in not in a naff way at all, actually.
Yeah, when you're not sure if it's in someone's head,
yes,
or if spooky things really are happening.
Exactly.
Or possibly a combination of both. Yeah, great. So when is that published? Do we know?
That's mid-January. I think it's the 15th or 16th of January.
All right, a quick one in the new year.
So soon, yeah.
Okay, great. And tell me about Belgrave Road, which is also on your list for next year.
Yes, so this is out at the end of January, I think the 29th. And it's just this wonderful, I think it's a debut novel. It's about these two people, Mira, who has moved to Leicester from India, to Belgrave Road, to marry someone that has been in arranged marriage. And she turns up there and she's feeling really homesick and lonely. She gets a job, really her father-in-law sort of forces her to get this job. And she meets this man, Talil, who's also there as an immigrant, but he's come from Somalia, and a sort of unlikely friendship or maybe something more big blossoms between them. And I love the style of writing. It's very simple, very descriptive and evocative, but it's not trying to be too flashy. It almost reminded me a little bit of Colm Bean and Brooklyn, that story of someone arriving in a new place and having to make the best of it, really.
Yeah. I mean, Brooklyn is a masterpiece, absolutely. I read it just after I'd moved to Brooklyn.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite moving. What do we know about Manish Chowdham?
This is his first novel, and I'm pretty sure that he grew up in Leicester as well. So it's really interesting, a look at a community that obviously lots of Indian immigrants moved to Leicester, and to see how that functions, because Mira turns up and she said, well, where are all the English people? I thought I was going to be somewhere English, and this just feels a little bit like home, but not quite like home. So it's a really interesting exploration of that kind of a place.
It's really interesting that both of those two books, the last two we've just talked about there, seem to have a very, very strong sense of place.
Yes.
Is that one of the things that always appeals to you when you're trying to pick out books, you know, to recommend?
Absolutely. I think it's either something that has a very strong sense of place or a very strong sense of character, a character that you really fall in love with, that it doesn't matter where they are, you'll kind of follow them everywhere.
I know that maybe it was last weekend or this weekend, the Sunday Times had the sort of best books of the year. If people are listening and they're thinking, okay, I haven't done my Christmas shopping yet, you know, I need to get my dad a book, maybe get my brother a book, maybe get my mum a book. What are the sort of top three from this year that you just think are no fail Christmas presents for the family?
Well, I think The Correspondent, as I've said, that'll be a fantastic pick. I think I'm probably going to get it from my mom. I hope she's not listening to this. then you've got sort of, when you look across the other genres, there are so many great history books from this year as well. Dominic Sandbrook made his number one, The Rage of Party, which was all about the emergence of different political parties in England, which sounds like it could be dull, but actually it's not. It's full of sort of guts and gore and rude things and all sorts of backstabbing, and that's really, really good fun. And then my other one, I think, would maybe be The Loneliness of Sonia and Sonny by Kiran Desai, because that's one that you've got bang for your buck. It's about 700 pages, and it's one of those big epic stories that you can just lose yourself in over the Christmas period, that weird in-between stage when there's nothing else to do.
Well, they'll be listening to Times Radio, because I'll presenting quite a lot in that betwixtmas. But when they finish listening to Times Radio, they can pick up a book. Laura, lovely to see you. Thank you so much for your picks. And what lucky people in your lives to have Laura recommending books for you for Christmas. She never gets it wrong. Lovely to see you, Laura. Coming up, we'll be discussing how to protect yourself from Christmas fraud with our money man, Adam Shaw. It is 14 minutes to four, and this is Jane Mulcairns on Times Radio with Wix. You can book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing, with intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
What good is sitting alone?
Winning a record-breaking 7 Olivier Awards, Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club is still the best musical in London, says the Daily Telegraph.
Life is a cabaret, old chum.
The most electrifying night out starts the minute you step inside. Outside it is winter, but in here it is so hot. So right this way, your stage side table is waiting. Book your tickets for a perfectly marvellous gift this Christmas at KitKat.club.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon, it's 12 minutes to four here on Times Radio with me, Jane Mulcairn, sitting in today for Jane and Fee. Now, the number of frauds jumped by a million incidents in the past year, with 4.2 million frauds in the year to March 2025. And with Christmas around the corner, shopping-based fraud schemes are likely to hit new highs too. Now, our money man, Adam Shaw, is an expert on fraud and is here to guide you through some of the most prevalent scams. Good afternoon, Adam.
Good afternoon. It's a shocking number, isn't it, that a million up? I mean, that's really bad.
I mean, I think that probably shows just how much people are struggling, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a reflection of lots of different things. I think partly it's a reflection of just how much we're doing online. It's much easier to be defrauded, especially this time of year. I don't know about you, but I'm doing a lot of shopping online rather than going to the shops. And you're open to these things in a way that you're not the rest of the year, partly because you're under time pressure. I haven't done all my Christmas shopping. I've got to get this stuff done. And that means you're under pressure. You've got to do things fast. It opens the door to criminals.
Well, we all know that is when we make lapses in attention as well. Mm. Let's start with the delivery scams, Adam, because I think, as you said, we do tend to get a lot of shopping delivered instead of going out this time of year. We might be getting things delivered to our home when we're out. We might miss a lot of deliveries. How can we try to defend ourselves against potential scams?
Right. Well, one of these is called the spray and pay scams, where the spray bit is they send out millions of emails to everyone. They spray them everywhere. So, for instance, I had one yesterday. It came from a delivery company called every EVRI, except it didn't. What they do is they send out all these millions in the expectation that some people will genuinely be getting a delivery from one of these firms. And it said, as a lot of them do, well, there's been a bit of a problem. You have to pay £4 or whatever to release this thing. Now, coming up to Christmas, you go, oh my goodness, I better get it. Now, I thought that's very unlikely. Why would I have to pay anyway? So it sounded odd. I clicked on the email sender's address. So it says every, but if you click on it, it reveals the real address. And it was some random person at a Gmail account. Mm. So it was nice evidence of how just that was absolutely corrupt. But also, it was an odd thing. Why would I be paying for someone to send me something? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. But it's a very common thing, especially at this time of year.
And I guess the spray bit, it just they send out so many, they're going to, it's a numbers game.
Some of them come back. Mm. And what they're also doing, you might go, well, it doesn't matter because they're asking for £2. So even if it is a scam, £2 isn't much. But what's going on here is that you're not just on the hook for the £2-4 you might lose. What you're probably going down a rabbit hole where they'll ask you some personal details, they'll ask you your bank details, they'll ask you your date of birth. Suddenly these criminals have an awful lot of information about you to take more money than the £2 or £4 or indeed impersonate you.
Obviously, people should just be aware of that. Check the email addresses and things. Try to remember which delivery company.
Yeah, no,
the menu
hard.
Parcel. It's very hard when you've ordered a lot of things, possibly from places that you haven't ordered them from before. Should these sort of things be reported to anyone? Is there anywhere you should be logging this?
Well, yes. It's just been renamed. But there's lots of official fraud tracking. And I've put all the sort of links on the article I've written in support of this little piece. The truth is, however, that is good for the nation that the police and the authorities track these things. It isn't a solution to your problem. Mm. If the money is gone, it is unlikely to be got back through those channels, I'm afraid. But of course, it is good that we can track them. It shows how many frauds are happening.
Yeah. Anna on the text has said there is a simple solution, go to the shops, which is a fair point.
No, that is a fair point.
We should support retail.
Yeah,
absolutely. Adam, you've also been looking at Facebook rip-offs with rogue adverts, which can trap people into multiple frauds.
Yes.
What's happening there?
So, well, I looked into a particular case, a chap called Graham, who saw an advert say, look, we've got loads of old computers out there. If you want it cheap, you have to register for £2. So he thought, £2 is not much, is it? Mm. I'll register because these computers are ludicrously cheap. So he spent £2 twice, actually. One £2, one £3, never heard anything. And didn't seem to matter so much. But what was going on was actually they did a recurring card payment authorization on his credit card and then took £45 over and over again. And that was the issue, that he thought, well, what if it is a scam? I've lost £3. That's not what he lost. In fact, he lost thousands of pounds, I think it was, overall. Now, actually, what you can do here, you can just tell the bank, I want to stop this. You are authorised to do that. If you see that, tell them to stop it very quickly. There's lots of also, it's a good general thing, if you're paying by credit card, you're protected by Section 75 of the Consumer Credit Act. Sounds exceptionally boring, but it is an incredibly important piece of legislation, which effectively means that if you're paying more than £100 and less than £30,000, the credit card provider will pay you back if you are defrauded.
Yeah.
So however you're dealing, if you're doing it on a credit card, not a debit card, a credit card, you are protected. And that's actually, I spoke to Graham, that's how he got his money back.
Well, it's actually worth looking into doing it on a credit card. And if you don't want the debt, you know, to hang around, you can pay it off straight away. But you are much more protected, aren't you, than you are from a debit card.
And credit cards are great things if you pay them off at the end of the month. Mm. If you don't, you pay really high interest rates. And if you need to borrow money, I would always suggest actually don't plan on borrowing money on a credit card. There are cheaper ways of doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just before we move on, Adam, is this just general Facebook or is this places like Facebook Marketplace where people are going to buy things?
Well, it's lots. I mean, unfortunately, lots of problems across that platform and others. It's not just a Facebook issue. And lots of people like pretending to be celebrities and endorsing them. And then you get a link from that celebrity. You trust that celebrity. So you go to the link and it's nothing to do with that celebrity at all. else. So it's across all social media, and it would be wrong to just highlight Facebook or Facebook markets. It's across all social media. You've really got to be aware. And it's a horrible thing to say you've got to be so cautious, but I'm afraid you do.
Yeah, I guess using social media as a retail platform, maybe you just have to give it two extra steps of security.
You do. And look, and I look at TikTok a lot, and there's lots of interesting things on TikTok.
Including Keir Starmer, apparently, from today.
You see, okay, yeah. I missed that, but okay. But even, dare I say, even more interesting than Keir Starmer, lots of things to buy over Christmas. But I'm very worried about handing sort of unknown people my credit card details on that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, one thing that is very popular at Christmas, and actually very popular in my family, because we all live in different countries to each other, and, you know, sending things is so expensive now, paying for postage and packing. Gift cards, they're a great idea. You know, you can get them for books, and you can get them for, you know, John Lewis, other department stores are available too. You can also get them for restaurants, you can get them all sorts of things. But gift cards are also being targeted by criminals, aren't they? How does that fraud work?
Well, often it's actually someone who might be got into your computer, found your friend's email addresses or numbers, and texted or emailed you, supposedly from this friend, and said, look, I've lost my credit card. I'm in a terrible situation. Can you quickly send me a gift card? And now what's happening again there is that's not a friend. That's impossible. Lots of people find this happens to their children, saying, Dad, Mum, I've lost my mobile phone. Quickly, can you do something? It's a similar sort of scheme. What they're doing is they've hacked your account or your friend's account. They've offered you this terrible situation and needs help, and what they're after is again all of your details. Similar things are happening with supposedly heavily discounted gift cards. They don't exist. And there's a particular thing going around right at the moment from the People's Postcode Lottery, which is offering a scratch card advent calendar with daily prizes, and lots of them are fake. They don't exist, and they are after your personal details again.
Right, so basically, if anyone asks you to send them a gift card, don't be worried about being a bit of a Scrooge and just say no.
No, I know, that I wouldn't suggest that. It's being a bit of a Scrooge. I would absolutely not suggest say no to charity and say no to no gifts. What I would say is actually, if someone's saying, I need help, call them independently, find out what this is. And that's true for a lot of these things, is you don't go down the channel that maybe the fraudster, if it is a fraudster, is forcing you down. You stop for a moment and go, well, hold on a second. And I'll just check this through another means. And that's true. People copy your telephone number and it looks like a friend's telephone number or it looks like your bank's telephone number, and it isn't. Yeah. I always hang up, politely hang up, find the number independently and call and go, did you just call me and ask me to transfer money or say there was a suspected fraud? And 100% of the times that has happened to me, it was a fraudster and not the bank.
Right. Adam, this is not Christmas related, but definitely related to the weather that we've been experiencing. There's something called the winter heating allowance scam that's been going on. Now, obviously, as we know, the winter fuel allowance is made to people to keep their homes warm. Yeah. So how is these payments to people turning out to be a scam?
Well, what's happening is because people are expecting them now directly to their banks, the criminals are texting or emailing them and saying, oh, there's been a bit of an admin problem here. You need to reapply and through this sort of link I'm giving you. Maybe they won't charge you, so you go, well, why not? I better do that. It looks very official. This is basically a traditional so-called phishing scam where they're after your bank details, your email address, your date of birth, other private information which they'll then probably publish and sell on the dark web. So other criminals will then bid to buy your personal information. And indeed, I went to someone's house and went, look at all the private information I've got of yours because you did this. So you have to be super careful.
Duper
and again, if that happens, you don't have to hit that link. If you think there's a problem with your winter fuel allowance, separately go to the government website and look at the winter fuel allowance.
Think twice, absolutely. Adam, so great to see you. Thank you so much for being here today. Adam has, of course, written a briefing for us, which you can find at themoneydoctor.tv and is on his website too. That's it from me today. Fee Glover and Roy Onika will be here tomorrow from 2. My producer today was Hannah Quinn and Ryan Boyden was a technical operator. Up next, it's John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine can't do without either Europe or America as he takes part in talks with Keir Starmer and European leaders at Downing Street. And a tsunami warning for eastern Russia and Japan has been issued after a 7.6 magnitude earthquake off Japan's northeastern coast. And coming up, I'll get the view from Kyiv, Brussels and London on Volodymyr Zelensky's meetings at Downing Street. And 30 years after the fatal stabbing of head teacher Philip Lawrence, I'll speak to one of his former pupils.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. An NHS nurse who complained about sharing a changing room with a transgender doctor as one part of her employment tribunal. Sandy Peggy was suspended after complaining about having to share changing facilities with Dr. Beth Upton at Victoria Hospital in Kirkcaldy on Christmas Eve 2023. She was placed on special leave after Upton, a male who identifies as a female, made an allegation of bullying and harassment and cited concerns about patient care. Peggy won a claim for harassment, but allegations of discrimination, indirect discrimination and victimisation were dismissed. A powerful 7.6 magnitude earthquake has struck off Japan's northeastern coast, triggering tsunami warnings. The country's weather agency says it could cause waves of up to 3 metres. An emergency task force has been set up to assess the extent of the damage. Oceanographer Dr. Simon Boxall says the area is prone to these kinds of events.
They are well prepared, but the northeast coast is very flat, which is why that 2011 tsunami penetrated so far inland. They are used to tsunamis in Japan, and they do occur on a reasonably regular basis, unfortunately.
The former footballer, Joey Barton, has been given a 6-month suspended sentence. It's for comments he posted on social media about football pundits Eni Aluko and Lucy Ward and the broadcaster Jeremy Vine. The 43-year-old was found guilty of 6 counts of sending a grossly offensive electronic communication with intent to cause distress or anxiety. Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine cannot do without either Europe or America as he meets Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz in Downing Street this afternoon. Macron says the Russian economy is starting to suffer, especially after the latest sanctions. Merz says he's sceptical about details in documents coming from the United States. Earlier, Donald Trump accused Zelensky of not reading his proposals following US talks with Moscow. Brent Sadler from American right-wing think tank the Heritage Foundation has told Times Radio the media caricature of the president is incorrect.
Often outside of the United States, you get a one-sided viewpoint that characterizes Trump as either being a patsy of Putin or overwhelmingly in favor of autocrats. And the truth is far from that, because it was Trump who actually killed over 100 mercenary Russians in Syria that were getting a little too close to U.S. forces.
Essex Police has confirmed it's looking at claims that Reform UK overspent on Nigel Farage's general election campaign in Clacton last year. Documents submitted by a former party councillor, Richard Everett, allegedly show the party spent over £20,000 more than allowed in the constituency. Reform denies doing so. And Paramount has launched a hostile bid for Warner Brothers challenging Netflix. It's offering $105 billion. Netflix has offered $72 billion. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, as Ukraine's third Christmas at war with Putin's Russia draws close, simply surviving this long as a country seems like a miracle. Today, the leaders of France and Germany have been sitting alongside Keir Starmer, gathered together with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky in Downing Street, pondering how to bring about another miracle, a just end to the war that respects Ukrainian territory and sovereignty and denies Putin the conquest that he wants. How, though? I'll have the latest for you on that meeting at number 10 in just a moment. And is President Trump the leader most capable of tilting the balance of the war back to blaming Zelensky for keeping the war going and not Putin? Trump's son, Don Jr., suggested that his father may wash his hands of the search for peace and walk away. Would he? And if he did, many believe Trump wants to do that if he can't claim the credit for any peace and a Nobel Prize to go with it. If Trump did walk away, what would be the leaders in Downing Street's view now? What would they do? What would Ukraine's other friends do? And what would you be saying if you were sitting at that Downing Street table? Do tell me. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Well, let's look at what's been going on. Keir Starmer hosting the meeting with the French president, the German chancellor and Volodymyr Zelensky in Downing Street. Europe increasingly left out of the peace process for Ukraine. Chancellor Merz was frank about his unease about the talks between America and Russia ahead of the meeting.
Nobody should doubt on our support for Ukraine. Firmly standing behind, and the outcome is open. I'm skeptical about some of the details which we are seeing in the documents coming from the US side, but we have to talk about that. That's why we are here.
That's Chancellor Merz of Germany. So let's first get the thoughts of Maxim Tucker, the Times Ukraine correspondent. Hi to you, Maxim.
Hello, John.
Hi. Well, so this, Maxim, was a pretty high-profile meeting. Any idea of what the outcome might have been? Was there anything that could be called an outcome?
Well, we're not seeing one yet, but I mean, I think this is a largely symbolic meeting. We've tended to see these kind of European leaders' meetings rallying around Zelensky when he faces a lot of pressure from Donald Trump and the US administration to accept an unfavourable peace deal. I mean, there are a few things that the Ukraine's allies could do while waiting for the US. They can obviously step up their rearmament. They can step up the amount of arms that they're sharing with Ukraine. They could even kind of put fighter jets in the sky over Western Ukraine. But we've seen a real reluctance to do that. And it's so far, it's just words, words, words. And I think that's going to be frustrating for Zelensky, although, of course, he appreciates the defense from the pressure of Donald Trump.
Indeed, indeed. Now, we can assume also that those leaders in Downing Street, Maxim, were puzzling, worrying about President Trump's commitment to the cause of Ukraine. It's always been so uncertain and has been so erratic.
It's been very erratic, but it does tend to lean back towards Donald Trump putting pressure on the Ukrainians and accepting that Russia seems to have, as he thinks, legitimate demands on Ukraine over the Donbass and Crimea. And this is the kind of thing that he's been saying way back since 2016. So, I mean, I think it's very worrying for European leaders that they might be see the US withdrawn entirely from this peace process. And I think what's really difficult for Ukraine and what's really difficult for Europe is that there's no way to replace this US intelligence sharing. The satellites that the US has in the air over Ukraine are really indispensable. And I think all of the kind of European participation going along with these Trump talks and Ukraine's participation in these negotiations with Russia, which don't really seem to be going anywhere, are aimed at keeping that intelligence sharing going.
And of course, Maxim, if Donald Trump were to walk away, that would be the ultimate challenge, wouldn't it, to the commitment of the European leaders and Ukraine's other friends?
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump, I think, would like to wash his hands of it. He's got great business interests in Russia. His children have business interests in Russia. Steve Witkoff has business interests with the Russians. I think this would it would do him a great deal of favor if he could lift sanctions and be done with this. But he still has to deal with some of those Republicans, you know, people within his own party who have been staunch defenders of Ukraine, even Marco Rubio, who has a different view on Ukraine to others in the Trump administration. So it isn't so easy